Water Quality Authority, which is a state agency formed in 1985 to develop a comprehensive plan to clean up and protect the sound. She's also worked with the Carter administration. She served on the White House domestic policy staff, where she handles environmental and natural resources issues. She's also taught environmental policy and nonprofit management here at UW. And she's worked for several other environmental organizations, including the Environmental Defense Fund. And she was in charge of energy conservation programs at Seattle Citywide. She's also served on nonprofit organization boards, including the Sierra Club, National Environmental Trust, and she's currently a member of the boards of the Restore America's Estuaries and the Washington Foundation for the Environment. So a really impressive background and experience she'll bring to you. She received her degree in biology from Harvard University, and she's a native of Seattle, so we're really lucky to have her back here in the Pacific Northwest. With that, let's offer a warm introduction to Kathy Fletcher.
Thank you very much, Anne, and thanks all of you for being here bright and early. This isn't my best time of day, I'll warn you ahead of time, but we will manage. I'm delighted to be here, and I know that the previous speakers have introduced you to a number of topics related to what I'm going to be talking about today, so hopefully part of what I'll do may help weave some things together, may offer some big picture perspective on what's happening with Puget Sound, and I'm going to weave in some history lessons as well. And if I do what I intend to do, I will wrap up in time for some questions. So this may feel like a bit of a fast pace as I move through this. First, a little bit about People for Puget Sound. Our mission is to protect and restore Puget Sound in the Northwest Straits. And we think about that in terms of the ecological resources, but also in terms of the people. And I hope that you'll take advantage of some of the handouts that I brought today, which are sitting in the chair right by the door, A, so that I don't have to carry them back to the office, but B, you'll get more of an introduction to the organization and hopefully some ideas about how you might get involved if you so choose. People for Puget Sound uses a variety of tools. We use science. We do a little bit of science, both by staff and volunteers, but we also use science. We make it our business to stay informed about the latest work that's been done about Puget Sound and to try to translate that and use that in our efforts to protect and restore the health of the sound's ecosystem. We also do a lot of education, and we think of that in the broadest sense, not just as school-based education, although we do that as well. We are also advocates for Puget Sound, and I guess it would be fair to say that we're the leading advocate organization working to move the system in favor of protecting and restoring the sound. And we're an involvement organization, which is suggested by our name as well. One of our goals is to get as many people as possible interested and involved in this long-term effort to protect and restore Puget Sound. We do hands-on projects to restore habitat. This is out in the Duwamish Estuary here in Seattle. Here's a happy volunteer. We take people out on the beach. This is a daytime shot, but one of the things that we like to do is take people out to the beach during the winter when the low tides are at night. A very exciting and wonderful time to introduce folks to the wonders of Puget Sound. Here's a picture of us in a more of a lobbying setting. This is our lobbyist, Bruce Wishart, and as the banners behind him indicate, we work with lots of other organizations as we do our work in Olympia. Here's a tugboat. Why would I be showing you a picture of a tugboat? One of the things we've been working on nonstop for over 10 years is to get a rescue tugboat stationed out at Nia Bay to help ships in trouble before they cause oil spills. And we've been successful in persuading everybody that this is a good idea, but we've been less than successful in making this a permanent feature of the landscape. Currently, this tugboat, or its successor, is funded on a seasonal basis, and after doing three saves to ships in trouble over a space of a couple of weeks, its money ran out, its funding ran out for this year on the 7th of March, so just a few days ago it left its station. So if something bad happens today, in this windstorm, we could have some serious trouble. We continue to work on trying to get this tug funded year-round and permanently. We do our work by working with others. There are lots of groups, and I know sometimes it's confusing to even figure out who's who, but rest assured that those of us working in this area are working together. And one of the main projects we've undertaken just recently is an alliance with two other very large organizations, the Nature Conservancy and the Trust for Public Land. We've embarked on a project to save the shorelines of Puget Sound, and that project's called the Alliance for Puget Sound Shorelines, appropriately enough. We also work with other environmental organizations in Olympia each year to set priorities for the legislature so that we can avoid the divide and conquer strategies that were common for many years, where we weren't working together and we, you know, would sometimes inadvertently undercut somebody else's efforts. So we work together through a coalition called Priorities for a Healthy Washington. Anne mentioned I sit on the Northwest Straits Commission. This is an effort in the seven northernmost counties in the Puget Sound area, which is actually most of the area. There are 12 counties in all. So the seven northernmost counties have come together to work on marine conservation, and this is an innovative and effective grassroots effort, interestingly funded at the federal level. So it's kind of a weird combination of federal action and grassroots effort. We also, People for Puget Sound coordinates the environmental community's engagement with the new Puget Sound Partnership, which I'll be talking about. But we have a group called the Puget Sound Environmental Caucus, which is now 40 plus groups working together to make sure that we're coordinated in our efforts to influence and shape the work of the Puget Sound Partnership. And that's just the beginning of the list, but I wanted to indicate how important partnerships are to our work. Now, why do we do this? Puget Sound is an amazing place, and some years ago I became really frustrated because it seemed, and my son was younger, seemed like all the kids knew how tropical rainforests were these fabulous places with all this amazing biodiversity. And nobody really thought about Puget Sound in that way. And yet there are literally thousands of species out there. It's an amazing place. It's just most of the time we don't see most of the things out there. But be proud of the fact that Puget Sound is one of the wonders of the world. There are, just as an example, over 3,000 species of invertebrates in Puget Sound. Three out of four of the critters up here on this slide are invertebrates. One of my friends likes saying that invertebrates are the backbone of the ecosystem, so you can remember that. And in thinking about how to convey what we're doing and why out in Puget Sound, sometimes I find myself teaching a little ecology on the side, and I've reduced it to two slides, so any of you who are taking ecology, forget it. All you need is to know that everything eats something and everything has a home. And if you think about those two things, pretty well figure out what we need to do to make Puget Sound safe and healthy for all the critters out there. So a quick review of what, why is Puget Sound in trouble? What threatens the health of the Sound and Straits? Well, we're the number one culprit. And, you know, people have come to Puget Sound in great numbers, and we keep coming. And the challenge, of course, is to figure out how we can reconcile the presence of so many people with our desire for a healthy, sustainable Puget Sound. This graph is doesn't even go back far enough to show when I was born. I'm so old. Let's see. I was born in 1950, and at that time, there were just about a million people in the Puget Sound Basin, nice round number. Well, today there are 4 million people in the Puget Sound Basin, and we're now working with the projection that over the next 15 years, another 1.5 million people will join us here with no end in sight. So if there's one thing that kind of encapsulates the challenge, it is the human population that is attempting to live here next to and around Puget Sound. One of the things that we've done to the Sound is that we've introduced a lot of toxic pollution into the Sound, both historically and on an ongoing basis. And a lot of these toxins are synthetic organic chemicals that don't break down readily in the environment. PCBs are mentioned on this slide as an example of a legacy pollutant in a way, because the manufacture of PCBs was banned in this country many years ago now. However, the use of PCBs was not banned at the same time, and so the fact that they were ubiquitous in electric equipment has continued to plague us over time, and there's still a lot of electrical equipment in use containing PCBs and the disposal of PCBs over time has been a huge problem, as well as some spills for critters such as those shown in this graph. PBDE is another example, a toxic flame retardant, relatively new on the scene, but already so ubiquitous that the state actually has taken action to ban the use of PBDEs in Washington State, or I'd rather to phase that out over the next couple of years. So we've addressed some of these toxic issues, chemical by chemical usually, and one of the problems is, of course, there's so many. This slide also is a simplified food chain to demonstrate the phenomenon of bioaccumulation. So the killer whale, the orca there, is really the victim of these toxic chemicals, even more than some of the smaller and shorter-lived creatures, and to the point where if an orca whale washes up dead on a beach, it's considered hazardous waste, but more in terms of what the impacts are, these whales are suffering from compromised immune systems and failure to reproduce at appropriate rates, and a lot of this is attributed to toxics. In addition, because the whales tend to store many of these toxins in their fat, when the salmon is not plentiful and they're living off their fat, they tend to get a rush of these toxins into their bloodstream, and that's when we tend to see bad years of a lot of orcas not showing up the following spring. Another huge issue for Puget Sound, and probably the biggest issue in terms of ongoing pollution today, and also the issue we're most concerned about as the population continues to grow. Sometimes this is called the stormwater issue. I've used the terms polluted runoff and impervious surfaces to get a little bit more meaning into that term stormwater, because why are we concerned? You know, it rains. That's not the problem. The problem is what happens after that, and that is that we've paved over so much of the surface area around Puget Sound between rooftops and literal pavement that and then introduced a lot of pollutants into our environment, that when the rain falls, those pollutants wash directly into water bodies. And of course, the hydrologic issues associated with that are many, and I know that you've heard quite a lot about that, but essentially we've had a lot of, are doing a lot of damage to habitats and stream flow as well because of our impervious surfaces. Habitat loss, a huge problem around Puget Sound, especially in the lowlands. We've obliterated about 75% of the original salt marshes around Puget Sound, just one example of the kinds of habitats that have really been seriously affected over time here in Puget Sound. Sewage, another issue very tightly linked to population growth as well. About a third of the people around Puget Sound are on septic systems, and two-thirds are on sewage treatment systems. Each of those systems has a number of issues. I'm not one who says one is inherently better than the other, but we have to not only be treating at appropriateness and successful levels, but we have to be anticipating population growth. And this is obviously a rural situation where septic systems have caused the closure of shellfish beds because of fecal contamination. Oil spills, a big issue for Puget Sound. This slide, of course, is a depiction of the Exxon Valdez spill in 1989 in Alaska. You may not be aware of the fact that every day there's a ship in at least the northern part of Puget Sound in the Straits that's capable of spilling more oil than was spilled by the Exxon Valdez. So this is not something that just could happen somewhere else. This is a very real and present danger here in Puget Sound. And of course, tankers represent about 10% of the large ships that come and go out of our waters. The other 90% are big cargo ships, and each one of them is a potential oil spill as well because of the amount of fuel that they carry. Oil spills, by the way, a catastrophic oil spill is considered by the scientific review panel that led to the endangered listing status for the orca whales. A catastrophic oil spill is considered the number one threat to the continued survival of Puget Sound's resident orca whales. So that's something to think about. Lastly, I want to just mention climate change as another one of the threats to Puget Sound's health. There are a number of issues associated with climate change that are making our job harder and will continue to make it harder to protect and restore the health of Puget Sound. First, rising sea levels raise a lot of challenges about shoreline management issues, and as we fight to take out a lot of the 800 miles of shoreline armoring that have already ringed Puget Sound, which total shoreline 2,500 miles, so 800 is a lot. As we attempt to get rid of a lot of that seawalling and armoring bulkheading around Puget Sound, and the sea level is rising, we're recognizing that there are going to be some additional stresses over this issue of how and whether we protect, quote-unquote, shoreline properties, and what's the best response to sea level rise in terms of both people and the ecosystem. Warmer water brings with it a number of issues, including some species that might happen to be at the edge of their range in terms of temperature regime. We may see and already are seeing some changes in critters that seem to like being in Puget Sound. And of course, there are issues about diseases that might be more prevalent in the shellfish industry, for example, because of warmer water. And then hydrologically, as we get more rain and less snow, the UW Group on Climate Change is predicting pretty much same amount of precipitation over the next decades, but coming in a different mix. That's another impact on hydrology that will exacerbate the issues that I mentioned when we were talking about stormwater. And along with that, more intense storms and more prolonged droughts. Imagine a salmon stream, for example, and what these issues may mean for salmon survival. Climate change and population growth also they just tell us that what we're dealing with when we talk about restoring the health of Puget Sound is a moving target. Now, a hockey great said, well, the trick is to skate to where the puck is going to go. And, you know, and that's sort of the challenge. How do we figure that out for Puget Sound? We're doing well when we address today's problems, frankly, and to anticipate and address tomorrow's problems before they're here. That's a tall order for our political system. So what does all this mean? I don't need to dwell on this, I'm sure, for this group, but we do have a number of species and groups of species that are in serious trouble. We're seeing huge declines in seabirds, the rockfish, bottom fish. These are long-lived fish that were overfished and knocked way back. Olympia oysters, their own story. That's our only native oyster. There are now efforts to restore the oyster, but very sensitive to environmental insults. And we've talked about the orca whale, now officially endangered. There are only 80 of the resident orca whales left in the Puget Sound system. And, of course, you've heard lots and lots about salmon. And I won't dwell on the interrelationships of all of these issues, but the point of this slide is just to say that one of the impacts of all these things I've been talking about is that we're seeing dramatic declines in many of the species that inhabit Puget Sound. The Hood Canal Dead Zone is a dramatic, specific case of what's happening out there. Those of you who've heard Jan Newton have heard a lot about the work that's being done to try to figure out in detail what's happening out in Hood Canal. But at a big picture level, too many nutrients going into the system, algal blooms, the decay of algae in a stratified system, sucking all the oxygen out of the water and causing these dead zone effects some summers and falls. We have a lot at stake in this region. I mean, the health of Puget Sound matters, and it matters to different people in different ways, but it matters. And whether it's a quality of life concern, whether it's an economic necessity, whether it is concern about the future of tribal cultures and human health, these are all issues that are interlinked with what I've been talking about, the threats to Puget Sound's health. So we understand what we need to do, and this is the list. The trouble is that each one of these things is a huge thing. We need to stop destroying habitat. We need to restore damaged places so that healthy habitats are not only out there in enough quantity, but they're connected to each other. We need to clean up the legacy of pollution, and we need to prevent future toxic contamination. We need to manage our stormwater to prevent the pollution and hydrologic effects that I mentioned. We need to prevent oil spills. And in order to do that, we have to live more sustainably. Fortunately, lots of us are hearing and doing more about that these days. Everybody wants to be green, it seems, which is great. And we do have a lot of environmental laws, but we've been not so good about enforcing and implementing them. So those two things at the bottom, living sustainably and enforcing and implementing our existing laws, would go a long way toward the list above. But each one of these things seems to be a huge challenge. So overall, where are we with the state of Puget Sound? This is a quote from the Puget Sound Action Team, which was the predecessor of the new Puget Sound Partnership. Their latest State of the Sound report, pretty depressing, but totally consistent with everything that we've heard and said about Puget Sound. The sound's overall trajectory continues to be one of decline, and it goes on with some detail about that. So in spite of a lot of good things that have happened, we have not turned the corner. We haven't kept up with the pace of decline. So one might expect that things would be a lot worse if we and others hadn't been working for so long trying to help Puget Sound. But what we've been doing hasn't nearly addressed the scale of the problem. Now, quick history lesson. These are not new issues. 1984, the legislature recognized that we needed a comprehensive strategy to protect and restore Puget Sound. They created the Puget Sound Water Quality Authority, which had been an advisory group, turned it into a real agency, said, go figure out what we need to do and how we need to do it. By the end of 1986, I was chairing that group. By the end of 1986, we did figure out what needed to be done. We adopted a management plan. In 1988, EPA, the federal government, followed along with a concern about estuaries nationwide, named Puget Sound an estuary of national significance, and in doing that, kind of adopted the state's strategy as the appropriate way to address the condition of Puget Sound. When the management plan was pulled together, it was like, oh, this is the greatest plan, this is wonderful, terrific work, you know, everybody thought it was great. But when it came to implementing it, it was like, oh, you mean me? Or what, you want money? No, I think they should do something, but I don't need to. All kinds of reasons that the implementation lagged, to put it nicely. It's a lot of contentious issues. For example, the issue of toxic contamination was very threatening to Boeing and some of the other legacy polluters, and very political, intense situation led to the reorganization of the Puget Sound Water Quality Authority that had been created with a sunset clause. So it had to go back to the legislature for whether it would continue or not. It was reorganized to be a kind of a behind-the-scenes technical advisory group to maintain the planning, but not to get out in front. And that's when I decided to form People for Puget Sound. That was 1991. It's kind of my personal timeline interwoven here, but in 1996, the legislature couldn't resist continuing to kind of tamper with the structure of this Puget Sound effort that the state was doing, and they decided to make it even more clear that the Puget Sound Water Quality Authority had no authority, so they changed its name to the Puget Sound Action Team and reorganized it again. And then skipping ahead, when the current governor was elected in 2004, the Hood Canal dead zone was coming on strong, and she expressed her great dismay. She'd been the director of the Department of Ecology back in the 80s, hadn't really been all that thrilled with the pressure that was being put on the Department of Ecology to perform better, but at the same time, she thought some things had been started then that were going to take effect. And so her reaction in 2004, it wasn't like she'd left town, but she'd been working on tobacco and other things. It was sort of like, what have you guys been doing for the last 20 years? Hood Canal's dying. And so she decided, okay, I'm going to do something about this. And she declared in 2005 that the Puget Sound was going to be healthy by the year 2020, if she had anything to say about it, which she does. So she created an advisory group called the Puget Sound Partnership to advise her on how to save the sound. This sounds a little bit like what happened in 1983-84. That group, which I served on, reported back to her and said, well, here's what we need to do. She and the legislature decided to turn the Puget Sound Partnership into an agency that had the mission to actually go out there and do it. And so in 2007, the legislature did create the new Puget Sound Partnership, which replaced the Puget Sound Action Team, which had replaced the Puget Sound Water Quality Authority. So now we have a new partnership. They are responsible for coming up with the plan to end all plans, the action agenda to protect and restore Puget Sound, with the funding plan to go with it, and September of this year is their deadline to come up with that. And of course, our timeline extends and asks some questions. Will the 2009 legislature rise to the occasion and come up with the funding or whatever else is deemed necessary at that point? And what will we see in 2020? Will somebody like me be giving a talk about how things have continued to decline despite our best efforts? Or will we say, hey, and this time it really worked? That's the question. So a lot of people want to know, well, what's healthy? What does that mean? I'm going to skip through this really quickly, but the scientific panel to the what I'm calling the old partnership now, this advisory group that was working in 2006, they came up with three key properties of healthy, which I like. Resilient to changes, redundant in its parts, and representing all the different types of biodiversity, or representing the diversity of the system. So that's a good working definition. The partnership itself, which is a more lay group of stakeholders, have put more of a human spin on healthy, which you'll see in some of the points here, which I'm not going to read. And then the governor took that and in three words pretty much said it, in my view: fishable, diggable, swimmable. That's kind of a play on the words of the Federal Clean Water Act, which is fishable and swimmable, with a Puget Sound word diggable thrown in there. But I think she deserves the Golden Clamshell Award for coming up with those three words, because I think it not only captures our human connection to Puget Sound, but if it is fishable, swimmable, and diggable, the critters are doing pretty well too. So in just reflecting on this history, this quick history lesson, we have to think about, in 1984, we pretty much knew what the issues were. Today, we've added climate change to that list, but not much else, other than that the numbers are larger and population and so forth. What's been missing, so my contention, what's been missing is not an understanding of what the issues are. What's been missing are our ability to do something about that and our commitment to do something about it. Throughout all these different bureaucratic changes, nobody has really been held accountable for the results out there. And in keeping with that, nobody's really been given the power that would make it reasonable to hold them accountable for the results. We haven't been able to sustain an effort over a long period of time, and frankly, if we're not going to succeed. This is a long-term effort, and it's got to withstand elections, changes of the issue du jour. The sustainability effort we've not achieved. Political will related to both of those things. Serious money, seems like we always want to do things on the cheap. We have invested serious money in Puget Sound. You need look no further than the investment being made in a new sewage treatment plant for King and Snohomish counties. We're putting serious money out there, but not really yet at the scale necessary. And speaking of scale, we've also managed over these last number of years to demonstrate just about everything we need to demonstrate in terms of effective ways of cleaning up toxic sediments, effective ways of restoring shoreline habitat. But we've been doing these in bits and pieces. We haven't yet gotten to the large scale. We've also protected pieces of the landscape, but also at fairly small scales. But we're talking about a whole ecosystem there. Now, we have learned some things from other places, and this is a whole other talk, but I urge you, if you're interested in pursuing this, the Government Accountability Office at the federal level, they're like the accounting arm of Congress, they've evaluated the Chesapeake, the Everglades, and the Great Lakes, principally because of tons of federal money going into those places, and we're so lucky not to have had tons of federal money yet, so we haven't fallen under their scrutiny. But believe me, they were incredibly critical of these efforts, along essentially the same lines that my list of what's missing in Puget Sound, pretty much the themes that come out of their reviews. In all of these places, they're looking for, well, who's making the decisions here? Who can we hold accountable? Is anybody responsible? You know, there are lots of committees, but, you know, where does the buck stop? And then linking funding to outcomes, that's a pretty interesting issue. Everybody wants money, but they want to measure it in terms of the activities that they're doing with the money and not really what the result is out in the ecosystem. They found that in spades in these other places, and they also found a lack of independent and transparent tracking of results. And that was meant both from the standpoint of science and monitoring in terms of what was happening in the ecosystem, but also in terms of expenditures of money. So now we have this new partnership. Here's their job. They have to restore the health of Puget Sound by 2020. Their plan to do that is due in September. They have a board chaired by William Ruckelshaus, who's spoken to this seminar. They have a 27-member ecosystem coordination board, which is like the advisory committee. That's the thing I sit on. They have a 9-member independent science panel. And they've also carved up the sound into 7 sub-regions that are causing a lot of confusion because they don't really match anybody else's lines on Puget Sound, but a way of looking at some of the issues on a more local basis to make sure that as they put the overall plan together, they don't lose some of the richness of detail and some of the diversity of concerns and emphasis around the sound. The statute that created the new partnership addresses accountability. In fact, that was probably the word used most often as the legislature was putting together the bill. And they got a long way toward somebody being in charge and some of these accountability issues. But they decided that the action agenda would not be a mandatory thing. And so it's still in a kind of netherworld, and we'll see how this plays out. It's not really regulation, but through incentives and job owning and some control over purse strings, the new partnership is going to have more influence than any of its predecessors. The action team, the authority, these groups never had any ability to control how money was spent, and the new partnership will. And they've also addressed the independent science issue by creating an independent science panel, and I think we'll have much more focus on results as opposed to activity and more transparency as we go through the process. Designating partners, I mentioned here, as part of the accountability package. That's part of the control over the purse strings. Once this action agenda is prepared, local governments may be able to, or others may be able to say, okay, we will fulfill this action agenda. We will do our part. And then the partnership may say, okay, well, you are officially a partner now, which means you're eligible for money that others aren't. So that's one of their leverage points as how they go about this. Serious money, are we going to get there? In a Tim Iman initiative atmosphere, I think we have to ask ourselves, are we going to get there and how? The old partnership estimated we needed to be spending at about twice the current rate of things that are going on in Puget Sound, rough ballpark figure, to get to a healthy sound by 2020. We'll see what the partnership comes up with by way of a funding plan, and we'll see in particular if the politicians have the guts to enact new revenue sources, otherwise known as taxes. We'll see how that goes. I'm not going to spend detail on the goals of the action agenda because it addresses all the issues that we've talked about so far today, but I want to mention in particular that this is not just about saltwater. This is about the whole basin. So their responsibility goes all the way up the watershed. Now, big question. Certainly my main question today, and I feel like this is our last best chance to do this thing right, to do this thing. And by that I mean putting in motion what will in fact result in a healthy Puget Sound, shall we say, in our lifetime. Hope to be alive in 2020. And the answer is it depends, of course. We're early yet in seeing what this partnership is going to be up to. So the people that have been entrusted with this responsibility, Ruckelshaus and his leadership council, the governor, the legislature, we've got elections coming up, you know, cast of characters will change over this time between now and 2020. So, and we depend a lot on people in the way our system works. We depend totally. But it'll also depend on what the public demands. And I think the partnership has this perception that the public is, you know, kind of ignorant enough about most of this that they operate probably in a pretty free area in terms of the specifics. And speaking of specifics, I think actually that the success of this depends on whether we will continue to allow politicians and others to get by with generalities about saving the sound, or are we going to require them to deliver on specifics? And by this I mean everyone is in favor of a healthy sound. You know, 97% of the public polled, legislators, there's not a single legislator that'll tell you, no, I don't want to save Puget Sound. But say, well, okay, so part of saving Puget Sound means that we shouldn't allow this huge new gravel dock to be built in the middle of orca and salmon habitat on Maury Island. Oh, well, you know, I don't know. There are a lot of sides to that question. So are the specifics going to match up with the lip service? So hope. I have a lot of hope. I have to be an optimist to have been working on this so long. But this time, emphasis on results, that's new. Funding for actions, if it happens, that'll be much better. Greater public engagement, critical. An ecosystem approach, you know, looking at the thing at scale. And accountability, for the first time, really confronting the issue of it, you know, we're not just going to applaud anything that's nice. We're actually going to try to figure out if we're getting to the goal. The fear, of course, is, you know, we're going to get embroiled in a lot more process, and that the big issues like land use and money, you know, that these big issues are going to be avoided, that in fact there won't be enough money, and then 20 years later we'll be asking what happened. I put that there because I think we need to remind ourselves we've been through this before, we've been disappointed before, our hopes have been dashed before, so we have to keep that in front of us. So reality, it is up to us, and that's part of what People for Puget Sound is in business for. That is what we're in business for. So us includes all of you getting involved, spreading the word, cleaning up our own act, demanding results. Just a few suggestions. You can get dirty for Puget Sound, literally and figuratively. You can become an activist or a volunteer through People for Puget Sound. You can go to the Mud Up website. There's the Mud Monster. Mud Up is a place for volunteer opportunities and education opportunities. There's actually a mud index, so if you want to get really dirty, remove Spartina with shovels, you can do that. If you want to go to a lecture, you can do that too. Get green for Puget Sound. This is the living sustainably part of the issue. I mean, we and everybody else has 10 things you can do, 10 more things, 10 more things. These are actually things we have to do. I mean, it's sort of cute, and sometimes you think, well, what difference does it really make if I take a canvas bag to the grocery store? Well, not a whole lot that first time, but it's part of an ethic that we need to develop, and I'll be part of a conspiracy to develop that ethic. So with that, quick run-through, I hope that I have saved a few minutes for your questions. Thank you very much. Debbie.
I have a question about the Brightwater plant. I think you referred to it. Can you talk a little bit about whether you think that's a good effort and describe it for people?
Yeah. The Brightwater plant is the new sewage treatment plant that I mentioned that's being built by King County, just barely over the border in Snohomish County, and the service area includes a little bit of Snohomish County. Because of all the population growth, we do need a new sewage treatment plant. Nobody wants it in their neighborhood, and there were a lot of site-related issues, contentiousness about where it went. And of course, there are a lot of issues about the level of technology. My quick assessment of that project is its location is a good one if we want to reuse the treated water. You know, traditionally we've located our sewage treatment plants on the shores of Puget Sound and just shove the water out there or into a river. This one is upstream of a lot of areas, including like a lot of golf courses and parks that can actually reuse some of that water, and I think that's going to become a critical issue in the future, and they're plumbing that plant to accommodate water reuse. I think that's a good thing. The technology is the most advanced of any sewage treatment plant around Puget Sound. That's a good thing. It's going to do a much better job of removing toxins. Removing toxins, a lot of that has to happen before it even gets to the treatment plant. But nevertheless, this is a good technology being employed at that plant. So I think the county made a good decision in moving ahead with it. Over time, I wonder whether we're going to be successful in the long run if we don't develop some more decentralized technologies for dealing with waste. I mean, this is the big central plant concept of how to do it. There was another question up there. Yes?
You mentioned about the breaching of seawalls. So my understanding of a seawall is that they're set up so that they can prevent some kind of flooding or something like that. So what are the kinds of seawalls that you're talking about breaching, and what do you see the effects of all that?
So when I say that 800 miles of Puget Sound shoreline are armored by seawalls, bulkheads, riprap, there are a lot of terms and different technologies of doing this. Most of that walling off of the shoreline has been done because the upland property owners perceive that that's what they need to do to prevent their property from being washed away by waves and from the water side. In reality, it's a much more complicated situation, and some of it very site-specific, because runoff issues and stripping vegetation on the upland, there are a lot of things that also affect what's happening to particular pieces of property. And many times, the bulkhead or the armoring actually makes things worse because, for one thing, what happens on the water side is that the waves come, they hit the wall, and then scour out the beach. And if you've walked a beach and looked at the bulkheads, you'll see, you can usually get an indication of what the level of the beach originally was and what the level is now after all of that scouring. That in turn has affected neighboring properties. Neighbors have probably had to put up bulkheads too, because the effect of the deflection of waves from one bulkhead leads to erosion on somebody else's property. And it's much, for lots of reasons, it's much more sensible to try to work with nature and have soft shorelines and use logs and vegetation and other things to try to maintain, and good practices up above to minimize erosion effects on property. There are a lot of other examples, like downtown Seattle is quote-unquote protected by a seawall, and that, of course, was a wall that was built in conjunction with obliterating the beach that used to be around Elliott Bay. And so that's kind of a different situation, where the wall is put in, land is, and garbage and everything put behind it and create artificial land. And the trick there in terms of restoration isn't to remove the seawall unless you're prepared to see, like my office building and others, just kind of go out into the water, but is to try to add features on the water side of the seawall that recreate some productive habitat. Because what we've lost there is beach. We've lost intertidal habitat, and that intertidal habitat, the part that is exposed at low tide and covered at high tide, that's the most productive part of the Puget Sound ecosystem, and so that's why seawalls are a problem. So, huge, interesting topic, maybe subject of a future seminar.
Let's thank Kathy Quinn. Thank you.